Welcome back, everybody. This is the Caught Red Podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jesse Light.
I'm Megan Light.
We are just two dog lovers talking about true crime, horror movies, and most likely our dogs, too. And it seems like it's been a minute since we've been on here and listening to our intro music.
Well, we did take a week off.
Yeah.
Jesse was a slacker, but it's fine. He's going to make us millionaires one day.
Yeah, right. But yeah, we missed y'all last week. We're glad to be back. Megan's got a special one for us today, I hope. But before that, I did watch two movies. I don't know if Megan was present for them or not. She was probably reading her book or she fell asleep midway through. But they sound like Jason Statham movies. One was The Bricklayer.
No, I was not around for that one.
You weren't?
I don't think I was.
That's the one your parents recommended for me to watch. It's got Aaron Eckhart in it.
Yeah, Two-Face.
Yeah, and all these like ex-CIA agents come back and are badasses, you know? Okay,
I was on the couch. I think I was reading.
But it sounds like a Jason Statham movie. Like,
oh, for sure.
The Beekeeper.
There you go, Christy.
The Bricklayer. But yeah, that one was an ex-CIA agent who is reactivated when an extortionist targets the agency. It's just fun. You know, it's not a great movie, but it's a fun watch. Action-packed. And then the other one, I like this one a little bit more, was The Baker.
Oh, yes, with Ron Perlman.
Yeah. You watched a little bit more of that one.
I did.
Yeah. So, same thing. He was a badass once upon a time, and he has to protect his granddaughter from some gangsters, so...
He does what he has to do.
Does what he's got to do, yeah. The Baker. I enjoyed that one, though. Because he was old enough to where... These guys could still beat up on him, but he still had some technique in there where he could kick some ass too, you know? Kind of like Liam Neeson or something.
Liam, oh my gosh. The guy who says, I'm done making movies. Oh, wait. Here's another action movie.
Where he's got like pinpoint marksmanship and all.
Despite his age and everything, yep.
Yeah. But that's about it, really. No new news with the critters, I don't guess.
I mean, we took Mowgli for his annual.
All good there.
He's healthy. Healthy boy. He'll be 7 this year, which is technically what you would consider a senior, but our vet calls that middle age because she knows it makes me feel better.
And he gets all the loving when he goes to the vet. He's such a good boy. And when he got groomed, too.
Oh, yeah.
He gives him all the kisses. The assistant was
the vet tech was like, oh, he got my tonsils.
Yeah, all the way up in there. He's a ladies' man, so.
He's a good boy. He just looks terrifying. Like, on the camera yesterday, we had a Worcester Fire Department firefighter. I don't know why I couldn't think of that word. Come to the house and he rang the doorbell. And of course, I can hear the dogs, mainly Mowgli. And I just hear the firefighters like, oh, hi, big buddy. Oh, you're a handsome boy. I can hear him talking to Mowgli.
And Mowgli gets up on his hind legs.
Oh, yeah.
And he looks like he's about 6 foot tall, which he is when he does that. And he's like, woo, 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 with his hair raised up. Not intimidating at all.
He's a little scary. But we need them to come back by. I'll donate to them. They're trying to get some new helmets for their department. He needs to come back by. I guess he thought because one car was in the driveway, because I drove the Jeep yesterday, that somebody was home, or else he probably wouldn't have stood there for so long talking to the dogs.
Oh, yeah, true. Well, Megan... It's got a case for us today, so
picking up Jesse's slack.
I've got one on the back burner. It's fine. I'm getting there.
It's fine. I don't mind.
You ready to do this thing?
Forever and a day.
Ooh.
My sources are the Oregon Health and Science University.
Branching out again?
Yeah, but it's not going to be in Oregon. I just use that site for a reference.
Gotcha.
The Charlotte Observer, Kansas.
Branching out again?
Yeah, well, yes, branching out, but not like Oregon, not going that way.
You got sites from all over the state.
It's
country.
Fine. Country. It's fine. Doof. Kansas City Star, the KCKPD, so Kansas City Police Department. Find a Grave, St. Louis Public Radio, good old Murderpedia. The book I read, because I was like, oh, I got to whip them together. I'll just go by my batch of books over here and grab one. Don't roll your eyes, sir. The book is called By the Side of the Road by Marla Bernard.
You weren't bothered at all to read a book. Come on.
No, not at all. And I did listen to another podcast that kind of goes over it. It's called True Murder, the Most Shocking Killers Podcast with Dan Zupansky. And if you haven't heard of this one, you need to check it out. Dan is either a journalist or an author himself, but what he does is he interviews other authors about their books. So he's very knowledgeable about his subjects and the text and the authors, and he asks a lot of great questions, but more importantly, he listens and he lets them speak and tell the story. So he had Marla Bernard on talking about the case, not so much the book, like not reading the book to anybody, anything like that, but her remembering the case while she was involved.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I've listened to that podcast for one of the other ones, another book that I have.
Dan the Man.
And it's the same way. He'll ask them great questions and then he just lets them go. He doesn't interrupt them, anything like that. Like I said, based off a book. And I had not heard of this one before I came across the book. It was one of those nights I was on Amazon and I was looking up things to do, right?
Stories to buy.
Right. And I would click on one. Then, of course, you know, you scroll to the bottom. It's like, other customers would like this if you click on this. And I was like, okay. And I found this book. And this is going to be the story of Anne Harrison. She was a 15-year-old girl who fell victim to two men who were career criminals in 1989. Anne Marie, or Annie to her friends, was from a decent-sized city, Raytown. It's located in Jackson County, Missouri. Raytown is a suburb of Kansas City, about 20 minutes or so outside the big city. And it earned its name because of William Ray, who was a blacksmith that set up shop on the Santa Fe Trail in 1848. In the late 80s, Kansas City outnumbered New York City's homicides, which is kind of wild to believe. But Raytown didn't have any issues like that or violent crimes. The most that you would get there would be some sort of traffic infarction.
And what?
Infraction. Oh my gosh, I couldn't say
infarction.
I don't know what that word was. The most that you would give be some kind of traffic infraction. I don't know where infarction came.
Live, one take.
It's fine. On the morning of March 22nd, 1989, right around 7 a.m., Anne Harrison walked out of her house and to the edge of her driveway to wait for the school bus. One of Anne's friends said that her mom made her get up earlier and get ready and made sure she was outside at 7 because Anne tended to have trouble getting to the stop on time. Every morning, Anne would do the same thing while she waited. She set her books down, her flute case, and her purse, all in this nice little neat stack. And she had on a very 80s outfit that day, a jean jacket. She had it covered in flair or like, you know, little pins and had it all decorated. She had a pair of pink pants and matching socks. Not even 10 minutes later, Janelle, Anne's mom, heard the bus honking its horn. She poked her head outside and didn't see her daughter, but saw her things were in their normal spot. So she waved at the driver like, hey, hey, hold on just a second. Let me go check. Like, hold on. Don't go anywhere. She looked around the house, maybe, and ran back inside for something, but she didn't find her. Anne wasn't in their backyard petting the dog. She wasn't at the neighbor's house where one of her classmates lived. The bus had already gone on to its next stop, and if Janelle found Anne, she'd be in trouble and she would just drive her to school herself. She didn't find her daughter anywhere. It was like Anne was just poof, gone. Her stomach started turning, and one of the greatest fears a parent could have was happening. First thing she did was call her husband Bob. Next was a call to the Kansas City police. Once Bob was home, he too would call the police, but specifically his brother Paul, who was a captain in the Kansas City Police Department. And he was over their air flight division, so the helicopters.
You've kind of had two bus stop ones in a row here.
Have I?
Yeah. The Horseshoe Lake one, right?
There wasn't a bus stop.
Which one was the bus stop? Pamela Carnahan, sorry. The one before your last one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
never mind. I was like, what are you talking about?
Pamela Carnahan, yeah. Go on.
Maybe I'm on a kick. It's fine. Almost
the Bus Stop Chronicles.
Oh, I like it. Almost immediately, there were search parties out looking for her. The canine units were out. The helicopters circled the neighborhood and the ones surrounding. Aerial searches were going to be done of the wooded areas and the deep valleys. Nothing. And I read that she was either 5'5 or 5'7, but how does a girl between those heights, 135 pounds, just vanish? There were no signs of struggle. Like I said, all of her things were neatly stacked at the end of the driveway. So only one thing came to mind, that sometime between 7 and 7:10 a.m., someone took Anne from right in front of her own home. And word spread fast throughout Raytown. Anne was well-loved in her community. She had a small little part-time job at a grocery store. She was on the honor roll. She was active in sports at her high school. She was active in the band. She was active in her church. Her sudden disappearance prompted the school and the teachers to pass out flyers. Her work put them up. And then there was even word being sent out on CB radios among the truckers in the area. A tip line was set up very quickly. A reward was posted. And it reached $4,000 in just a couple of hours. In the following months, it would go up to $9,000. No one wasted time in Anne's case. And I wish that could be the same for some others. You know, a lot of times police would just say a teenager was being a teenager. Maybe they ran away or they're just trying to like hide out for a bit, didn't want to go to school. But that wasn't the case here. Everyone knew that wasn't something Anne would do. Not to mention her boyfriend David had been diagnosed with cancer and was in the hospital, and she had plans to go visit him when school ended that Wednesday afternoon. David had been diagnosed with some sort of cancer in his right leg. When I was looking it up, because I'm just a curious critter, I came across peripheral nerve tumors, and there are three types. Neurofibroma, schwannoma, and then MPNST, which is also malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors.
So it was one of those three?
It had to be one of those three. He was first diagnosed in 1986, and then it came back in 1988. One of the Kansas City Star articles that I came across interviewed David in 2015, which meant hopefully the cancer had gone to remission. He's still alive. And I do think he's still living as well, because I found what I think is his LinkedIn page.
I mean, he'd only be 15 years older than you.
But still, if he had cancer.
True. Just remove his leg. It's fine.
I don't know. All this movement's going on that very first day. But sadly, there were no signs of Anne. Unknown at the time, just hours before Anne was abducted, a Lee's Summit officer had spotted a vehicle with a broken taillight and had begun a high-speed chase after it. Lee's Summit is kind of like Raytown. It's another suburb right outside Kansas City. As his car and the officer were going upwards to 90-plus miles an hour, the officer had to suspend the chase because the car had reached the city limits of Kansas City at 3:32 a.m., and because of policies and procedures, the pursuit of the vehicle for a traffic infraction was not allowed in another jurisdiction. Nothing major, just tail light out. They can't go into a different area to keep going. The next evening, on March 23rd, around 6:55 p.m., a caller had contacted dispatch about an abandoned car being parked in front of his house. He said the car had been there since like 8:30 the previous day, Wednesday, the day Anne went missing. The responding officer, Tommy Williams, ran the plates, and he learned that this 1984 Chevy Monte Carlo had been reported as stolen the previous day, so Wednesday. There was also another report of a stolen car from the same time, from the same area, an apartment complex in Grandview, Kansas. The officer took fingerprints from the Monte Carlo while dispatch got a hold of the owners. At 7:40 p.m., the owner and her boyfriend arrived with the keys and some antifreeze. The car must have overheated, so that's why it got dumped. That's their theory. The boyfriend topped off the reservoir. He walked to the back of the car to put the remainder of the jug in the trunk, and once he opened it, he wished he hadn't. His scream alerted the officer, and it was there where Officer Williams also saw the body of a young white female. The body of Anne Marie Harrison had been discovered 37 hours later in the trunk of a stolen car. Many officers and detectives and their superiors were called and informed. Captain Paul Harrison, Anne's uncle, volunteered to properly identify her body and spare her parents of seeing that. Sergeant Troy Cole from the homicide unit was given control of the scene. He had led the task force that took down Robert Berdella, a.k.a. the Kansas City Butcher. And that guy, whew, he was a serial killer spreading terror in Kansas City from 1984 to 87. He would capture, rape, and torture young men for weeks before murdering them. So this guy helped catch him. Sergeant Cole would hand the case off to Sergeant Pete Edlund, who had been the one who was on call when Anne had gone missing. So it's technically his case now. And then Anne's case also would have the help of the Murder Squad, which was officially formed the year prior in 1988. And I picture this team, like the team from The Closer, like the Priority, you know, Murder Squad or the Major Crimes Division, like they go, they have the specific detectives assigned to that unit that just focus on one case and solve it. So she's got big guns on her side. When she was discovered, Anne had been laying on her left side, appearing to be fully clothed. But near her in the trunk, detectives found her bra, a shoe, and her jean jacket. Just from the visibility, from what they could see, there was blood around her mouth and nose and on her pants. And they could tell that she had suffered from multiple stab wounds and had a large cut on her throat. She was removed from the trunk and taken to the medical examiner's office, and the regional crime lab took their time going over the Monte Carlo, being sure not to miss anything. Anne's autopsy was done almost immediately, just hours after her body was found at 1 in the morning on the 24th. Anne was documented wearing the same clothes she left for school in. Based on livor mortis, the position she was found in meant that she most likely died in that position, meaning she was killed in the trunk. There are 10 noted wounds. all from some sort of sharp instrument, all within the midsection going up to her neck, and then a couple in her upper extremities. Impressions were made so they could eventually match a weapon, hopefully. Blood samples were taken, other small particles were taken for testing, a rape kit was performed, and swabs were taken. There was evidence of forcible sexual assault.
I feel like there's probably fingerprints all over the car and the trunk. And
they were taking everything, yes. Yeah. She had markings on her wrist indicate she'd been restrained at some point. The medical examiner determined that Anne was conscious 15 minutes following the stabbings and was still alive for about 2 hours lying in that trunk. A second ago, I mentioned that there was a second car reported stolen from the same area, Grandview, around the same time as the Monte Carlo. The second car was a 1979 two-door white Buick. Seeing that it was odd and a bit of a coincidence, they added that report to Anne's file and officers were sent out to try and locate it. They would find it on the 24th, the day after Anne was found. It joined the Monte Carlo in evidence and the crime lab started on it. There were pry marks on the driver's side lock and damage to the left side of the steering column, all identical to the markings on the Monte Carlo. The dome lights in both the cars had been removed. The cassette player was gone. The thieves had taken the radios clean out. And the two cars had similar items taken from each, so both cars were very consistent with each other. 2 days later, on March 26th, Grandview Police notified the Kansas City Homicide Unit about a green 1980 Chevy Citation that had been abandoned. Like the Lee's Summit officer, the Grandview Police couldn't continue pursuit into Kansas City's city limits. When an officer finally caught up to it, the suspects had fled the scene on foot, seen to be two black males leaving the car behind. When he approached the abandoned car, he saw that the steering column had been busted. The door lock looked like it had been pried off. The dome light was missing. The radio had also been pulled out, but whoever was in the car just left it on the floorboard, likely in the process of taking it when they were getting chased. This car was also taken to the crime lab to be processed. Despite all their legwork, they just couldn't find any leads. Until 1 week after Anne's abduction and murder, a man contacted detectives about some property damage to a vehicle that he had witnessed. Just after midnight on the 22nd, this man said that two black males were in a white Buick. He could see them driving up the street and stop at a residence nearby. The man in the passenger seat got out with some object and broke the window of a truck parked at that residence. The man said he turned on his porch light and he slammed his front door a few times and spooked him. Because it worked, the passenger got back into that Buick and off they went. He said the passenger was tall and thin and had on a dark baseball hat. There was a matching report from the truck owner that gave this man's story credibility. Someone else came forward with the lead. A woman was heading to work on the 22nd and said that before 7 a.m., there was a blue car driving erratically on the highway. She could see that both were black males and the one in the passenger seat was wearing a baseball cap. But she kept her distance and couldn't get the license plate. Another week or so goes by and another report of an abandoned vehicle comes in. It's a 1986 Chevy Cavalier, stolen on April 15th. The damage and the items taken were consistent with those involved in Anne's case. On April 22nd, there was a 1976 Caddy recovered. Around May 4th, there was a 1985 Chevy Monte Carlo, a different one, recovered. Word must have been spreading around the people that lived in these areas because this is about the time someone called the tip line about a couple of known car thieves from the area. Roderick Nunley and Michael Anthony Taylor. Everything done to these cars were Nunley's trademark, and then Taylor learned from him, kind of like his protege. The two went way back. They were old friends from the neighborhood. Taylor had 9 felony convictions for burglary, stealing and tampering, running away from the custody of his halfway house. Nunley had a similar record, plus he had been a suspect in an unrelated homicide. The two of them loved to steal cars. They would sell the parts to fund their drug habits and then just some walking around cash. By this time, being May 1989, Nunley was sitting in the Jackson County Detention Center after he was arrested for a car theft he did in February. And yes, they're the same type of damages done to that car as the one in Ann's case. Detectives go to interview him twice, and both times Nunley denied to say anything. He wouldn't speak without an attorney. He was a dead end. And he's a professional. He knew how to play the game by this point. So it makes him kind of smart, but he's really not, because his confidence and his pride would catch up with him. He ran his mouth, and the person he told all sorts of stuff to decided to make an anonymous call to the tip line.
Trying to get a lesser sentence.
Trying to get some. On June 21st, this caller said he knew who killed Ann Harrison. He said that he learned from Nunley and his friend Taylor that they were involved with kidnapping a girl they called Annie and raped her and stabbed her to death. Taylor had apparently always wanted to do a white girl, and grabbing her was his idea. Nunley just wanted to steal car parts for money, but it went too far. Roderick Nunley was the one who killed her. They had taken her to Nunley's mother's house, which is in Grandview, where all the first cars were stolen. The first 2 cars from the reports were stolen. Nunley had cut her throat and made Taylor stab her so he'd be part of the murder. The caller made it clear that he was only calling for the reward money, and he would call back the next day with more information. He was true to that word. He called back, and this time the person who was taking his tip off the line convinced him to talk to detectives in the homicide unit. He ends up identifying himself as Kareem Hurley, and he agreed to come in and give a statement. Much of what he already told on the tip line, yes, he retold the detectives, but the thing was, the information he's giving is something only the killer could have known. So he's pretty credible to detectives at this point. Hurley said that Nunley and Taylor intended to rob Ann, but they took her instead. Again, they took her to Nunley's mother's house. They took her into the basement so Taylor could rape her. They wouldn't find any blood there because she was killed in the trunk. I mean, all these things are checkmark, everything he's telling the detectives. Hurley also told them that Nunley would be hard to crack, so they better go after Taylor. And conveniently, Michael Taylor was back in prison on a parole violation, so they knew exactly where to find him. When detectives went to speak with him, all he asked for was to talk to his mom. But she wasn't home, so he spoke to his sister. On the phone, she was like, just tell the truth, be honest. Obviously, Taylor shifted the blame onto Nunley. Said that he was high on a drug binge. It was Nunley who tried to rape her, but he just couldn't get it up. Unknown to Taylor at that time, the evidence showed that it was only him who had raped Annie because only his DNA was found. One of the first warrants granted was a search warrant for Nunley's mother's house, specifically the basement. Crime scene techs do a thorough sweep, gather evidence like the carpet and pieces of the wood wall paneling. Detectives were given a second warrant that would include kitchen knives based on what Taylor told the detectives. And this is some shit. They go to serve the second warrant, and there's no answer at the house. So They find an unlocked window and have to let themselves inside, only to be surprised when Nunley's mom and sister were just sitting there on the couch. They wouldn't answer the door because they're adamant that Nunley had nothing to do with it. Nunley's sister said she was even home on the day of the incident, March 22nd, and never heard anything going on in the basement. Liar, liar, pants on fire is what I call that.
Pieces of shit.
But here is some sweet satisfaction. We all know that there are certain things in prison that inmates won't tolerate. And though many of them are monsters themselves, I guess you could say some find rape and murder of a minor to be disgusted and frowned upon. The first steps of justice for Anne came when Michael Taylor was assaulted and gang raped and required surgery to repair him.
Mm. They know what you're in there for.
He got a taste of his own medicine. I'm not sure if that assault was before or after June 23rd, 1989, which is when Michael Taylor would be recorded. His confession actually recorded and on record. He waived his Miranda rights and was informed of Kareem Hurley's statement, which gave them secondhand knowledge of Anne's case details. As Roderick Nunley's partner in crime, he gave his version of March 22nd. He said they were riding around, taking things from different cars to sell to this guy they knew, Doyle, at his body shop. Taylor said that he was driving and they passed this girl standing there. Nunley told him to go back. Nunley got out of the car, tried talking to her, and the next thing Taylor knew, Nunley had practically tackled her, threw her on his shoulders, and got her in the car. And she's screaming and kicking at the dashboard. And Nunley put a screwdriver to her ribs and told her to stop, and if she didn't, he would stick her with it. Nunley told Taylor to drive to his mom's, and Taylor did, parking in the garage. Nunley told Taylor to take the girl to the basement, where she was tied up with some cable wire that was just laying around. And while she was in the car, Nunley had blindfolded her somehow with his own sock. I don't know if he had like a big sock and pulled it over her face, or they tied it around her head somehow. I was like, that's a big-ass sock. Whatever. Taylor said it was Nunley that began to undress her and have sex with her, and then told Taylor it was his turn, but he didn't want to. Nunley bullied him into it, and Taylor said he didn't even finish because the whole thing was just too much and upsetting, which we know DNA contradicts because they found semen. Afterwards, she was crying, and he untied her to let her get dressed. She kept telling them that she knew people and they would come for her. And I guess that spooked them enough because Taylor and Nunley tied her up again, blindfolded her, walked her to the car, forcing her in the trunk. Nunley disappeared for a moment and then returned with two knives, one larger, kind of like a butcher knife, and the other was small and serrated. He said Nunley made the first move by grabbing her hair to pull her head up and try to cut her throat, but the knife was too dull for that. So the stabbings began. Nunley did the most damage while Taylor only made a couple of wounds. Taylor said, I guess we're in this together. Taylor refused to drive that car again with the girl in the trunk, so he followed Nunley in Nunley's car, which was a gold Buick Electra, which is just another car that Nunley had stolen. But before they headed out, Nunley took his sock back off Anne's head, and it was bloodied, and he took it inside, and he flushed it down a toilet. It's kind of an odd detail. The detectives asked about the car. He admitted that the same car she was killed in was the one they picked her up in, that blue Monte Carlo. When asked if anything happened that day with the car, Taylor said, yeah, we got chased by the police. So if you remember earlier, I talked about Lee's Summit officer going on a high-speed chase that ended because he couldn't go into Kansas City over a busted taillight. Just think how different that would have been if that officer had been able to stop them and would more than likely still be alive. Taylor went on to talk about how they were drunk and high and their technique about breaking into cars and selling parts to their buddy Doyle.
They probably knew that if they drove into Kansas City that they weren't going to follow them all the way.
I'm sure they did know. His confession plus Kareem Hurley's statement gave them more than enough to get an arrest warrant for Roderick Nunley, but first they have to find him. On file, Nunley had a couple of different places of employment listed, but he had either been fired or stopped showing up. They go back to Nunley's mother's house and he's not there. Of course, his mother and his sister are trying to protect him. They refuse to be any help. He's finally spotted by a resident in Kansas City on July 8th. Nunley fled on foot from officers, but is eventually taken into custody. Detectives were like, listen, we've got Taylor's confession. I don't even know if we need yours. If you don't want to talk, it's your word and Kareem's against you. Nunley assumed they were lying about the confession because Taylor is one of his oldest and closest friends. There's no way he's going to snitch. The detectives gladly show Nunley the confession tape, and on it, Taylor puts all of everything on the line. Their loyalty, their friendship, it's like nothing meant anything to him. And now, Nunley, feeling betrayed, is ready to play ball and defend himself. Months prior, Nunley, when he was in county jail for those car theft charges, he wouldn't speak about anything, the cars or Anne, but now he's waiving all his Miranda rights. His version of events were complete opposite of Taylor. Whatever Taylor said Nunley did, Nunley said it was Taylor. A case of he said, he said.
Right, but then Taylor's semen's found, so it's obviously Taylor that did the majority of the shitty stuff.
Yeah. If that wasn't enough for him to get his buddy in hot water, Nunley also offered them Kareem Hurley on a silver platter. It was pretty much because of Kareem Hurley coming forward that Nunley and Taylor were even found out. Nunley said Kareem and him did two other crimes together, robbing two women in two separate incidents, and there are police reports matching these. He also told them that Kareem had murdered this guy from their neighborhood. But this guy that was shot was someone that Kareem had put the blame on Nunley. So again, it's more that he said stuff. Like, who's right?
Who cares? Lock them all up and that's throw fine. Away the key.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But Kareem didn't kill and rape an underage girl, so.
No, he did not. On July 28th, 1989, the grand jury indicted both men on first-degree murder, forcible rape, kidnapping, and armed criminal action. There'll be quite a few issues with their case, like going through two different judges and courthouses before settling on a final third option for a judge. Both men would be heard by the judge himself and not have a jury trial because they pleaded guilty. Another issue was that Michael Taylor escaped custody twice. Both times he was found rather quickly. Nunley's trial was on January 29th, 1991. Nunley stated that his intention was just to rob Anne. He admitted to abducting and killing her, was adamant, though, that he never raped her, that it was all Taylor. Like I said earlier, DNA does prove this. Only Taylor's DNA was ever found on the girl, like, in that way. His reasoning for killing her was because she could identify them. Nunley, like I said, he pleaded guilty, and based on the charges, the judge sentenced him to death. Michael Taylor's trial was February 9th, 1991. He also decided to plead guilty to his charges and, like Nunley, forego a jury trial. In his statements to the judge, he said he wanted to let Anne go, but he was afraid to stand up to Nunley. He told the judge how much Anne fought them and for her life, and she begged, and she said her parents would pay for her to come home. He, too, was sentenced to death. March 20th, 1991, Kareem Hurley took the stand and testified about being the tip line caller. He did, in fact, receive that reward money, which ended up being about $9,000. He had to use it to pay for a defense attorney for the allegations that Nunley spat against him and his involvement in some thefts.
That sucks.
Yeah. Oddly enough, in about a decade, Hurley found himself in a similar situation with the courts. He was arrested in 2003 on assault and rape charges, and he was sentenced to life in prison. October 1991, Nunley and Taylor appealed their sentencing, stating the judge was drunk. The prosecution was racist, and their own attorneys were incompetent. So they have three reasons why they're trying to appeal.
Good luck with that.
Right. So they get new attorneys. The judge does remove himself because apparently someone witnessed him having an adult drink during a lunch break while he was listening to their cases. The prosecution had suggested the death penalty, not life in prison, and this is the reasoning why the prosecution is racist. They said that they were black men and the victim was white female. That's why they only were given the death penalty option, not life in prison. The Missouri Supreme Court took over their appeals and began to go through them with a fine-tooth comb. All three of those accusations were pretty serious in their eyes. And after 5 months, both Taylor and Nunley's appeals were denied. The judge elected from the Supreme Court kept the death penalty sentencing for both men. After he went through the files and all the evidence against him, he was like, yes, it sticks. The appeals, regardless of their initial reasonings, they had no basis. These men would file more appeals over the years from 1993 well into the 2000s. Michael Taylor's original execution date was supposed to be February 1st, 2006. Roderick Nunley's was supposed to be October 20th, 2010. Both received temporary stays of their execution because of all that mess with all their different appeals and then like the states involved and the Supreme Court's involved. It was just a shit show. Finally, on February 26, 2014, Michael Taylor died from lethal injection. His execution came 4 days after what would have been Anne Harrison's 40th birthday. Roderick Nunley died from lethal injection on September 1st, 2015. The Harrison family had to endure the loss of their child at such a young age and then go through the trenches with law enforcement and the courts for 26 years to finally get justice. And that is the story of Anne Marie Harrison.
Good job, love.
Thank you. That was some shit, huh?
Yeah, at least the justice system
worked out.
Worked out this time.
I hate they had to go through so many hoops. Because these two men were afraid to pretty much, it was either, they're going to either die from lethal injection or they're going to die in prison. That's how I look at it. But
they probably thought that they would have had a chance for parole at some point or another.
I mean, you're career criminals, first of all. And then you are involved with the murder and rape of a minor, a young girl who has law enforcement connections. You were never going to get out regardless.
Yeah, and if they didn't get caught doing that, they would have tried it again.
Probably.
Done worse and worse things, probably. And they abducted her in broad daylight.
Yes.
Like, what, 7 in the morning?
Between 7 and 7:10 a.m. There, in the book, there were a few mentions of, like, neighbors seeing a blue car speed off, but some people thought a brown car was speeding off. There, you know, because aren't really super reliable. But yeah, everybody is you know, getting ready to go to work or getting ready to go to school. And you just, it's a shocker that they really weren't spotted pulling her into the car. And how are you going to say you were just going to rob her?
Yeah.
And then leave everything else behind and take her.
She had nothing to take, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean,
she didn't have a cell phone in 1989 or whenever it was.
She probably had a couple dollars for like lunch money and like a chapstick.
I mean,
yeah. It's sad. Very sad.
Just terrible human beings out there.
Well, they didn't waste any time looking for her. And I know it's probably because her uncle was law enforcement. And I think her dad was a reserve deputy or used to be. Also, so, I mean, they had connections. I just wish more cases were that quick. They are for little kids, but, you know, as they get older, like I said, a lot of times they just think a teenager's run off or they're skipping school.
Yeah.
And most of the time they probably are just blowing off steam. But, and you know, one out of how many instances is something serious?
Yeah, and then when you get even older and you're an adult,
oh yeah,
and you go missing, and then it's, yeah, because the one I'm looking into,
oh,
it's like they couldn't care less.
That's sad.
Then there's hardly any information on this guy, but clearly something happened because he couldn't have just vanished off the face of the earth. So,
no. Unless aliens come and
maybe you never know.
We did watch that movie.
Oh yeah. Well, that wraps up today's episode. We will be back next week.
We will.
We will be back.
I'll prep another one just in case.
If I'm not ready for one, Megan will have one ready. But
well, we're on it. Life just happens, man. It's fun.
Has been pretty busy last couple of months. So, productive at least. Not so much in the cases and stuff, but
hey,
just in work.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
I don't mind.
Y'all continue to follow along on Instagram, Caught Red Podcast. That's PAWD. Leave us a review if you like us. Let us know if you have any cases that you'd like us to research and check out. We might be able to talk about them on here.
Yeah, we had one girl.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Oh, that's the one you're looking into? Ooh.
Yeah, I think I might add another one into the
mix.
Episode with it, because it will end up being a short one just because there's not much out there about the guy. But
oh, I'm glad you're gonna do that then.
There is another case from the same area where someone went missing. I gotta look more into that though.
Ooh, love.
Getting there.
I like it.
But yeah, until next time, stay local, shop local,
murder local.